I can remember as a boy dreaming of the wilderness. I don't know where I got these ideas way back in the 1950s, but I had the railroad track running right past my grandpa's farm. And you know, those trains would go by, I'd run up to and watch them, and then I'd watch them fading off into the distance, and I would dream about what was down that railroad track. And I just imagined there were canyons and rivers and fish and elk and moose and all this wonderful stuff that we never saw in the cornfields of eastern South Dakota. So I just kind of naturally hung out with my cousins and older boys who would go out and seine for minnows in the creek and try to get rabbits with the BB gun and all the usual stuff. And I just got so taken with it that by the time I got into high school, I sort of gave up sports. Of course, I played baseball and all the sports with the rest of the guys. But gosh, when I realized that, for instance, football season would be going on when pheasant season was open, I lost interest in footballs really quickly.
Today on the Winchester Life Podcast, we sit down with Ron Spomer, a man who turned a boyhood obsession with the prairies of South Dakota into a 45-year career behind the rifle, the camera, and the pen. From homemade bows in his grandfather's woodlot to chasing over 70 big game species across the globe, Ron's journey is anything but conventional. Built on grit, curiosity, and a refusal to follow the expected path. He's worked the real jobs, lived the freelance grind, and somehow carved out a life that blends shooting expertise, storytelling, and a deep-rooted respect for the land. In this episode, we dig into the mindset behind his success, his connection to the iconic brand of Winchester, and the no-nonsense perspective he's built after decades in the field. This is the Winchester Life Podcast, and today's guest is Ron Spomer. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. Through insider access to industry pioneers, firsthand looks at cutting-edge tech advancements, and the stories behind the scenes that have shaped the world of shooting sports and hunting as we know it, we'll dive into the sacred places like deer camps and duck blinds, talk about innovation and shooting tips with the world's best, while revisiting age-old traditions of hunting and shooting still alive in our country. I'm your host, Jason Brown, and welcome to the show. The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Firearms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Winchester Kentucky Straight Bourbon, Winchester Air Rifles, and Winchester Optics. Well, Ron Spomer is the next guest on the Winchester Life Podcast. Ron, thanks for carving some time out of your day this spring, and excited to talk with you.
Well, happy to be here, Jason.
I think, it's funny. We've been working with Winchester for probably 15 years, but your history with them goes back way before that.
And,
Yeah, I mean, what, 25 years? Or when did things start with you and Winchester?
Well, they really started back in the 60s when I was buying Winchester ammunition for my rabbit and pheasant hunting.
Yeah.
But they started sponsoring some television shows that I did, I think it was 2005. And a pretty exciting time. Prior to that, I'd been writing for all the hunting magazines and such, and it really hadn't done any TV. And then got invited by a producer to host a show. And it was Winchester sponsoring it. And boy, we had a blast doing shows after that. We flew all over hunting everything from, I don't remember if we did a sheep hunt, but we did caribou hunts and moose hunts and mountain goat hunts, as well as all the deer and elk and usual stuff. So yeah, it was a blast.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, backing up a little bit, you grew up in South Dakota, and chasing pheasants, building bows, a lot of the things I've read about you, that was a huge part of your life. And you were able to kind of parlay that into a career in the outdoors. Kind of walk me through that whole process.
Yeah, I think a lot of country folk will be familiar with it. You grow up in the country and you're just naturally attracted to the outdoors. You want to hunt, you want to fish, you see the wildlife and you want to involve yourself in that excitement. I can remember as a boy dreaming of the wilderness. I don't know where I got these ideas way back in the 1950s, but I had the railroad track running right past my grandpa's farm. And you know, those trains would go by, I'd run up to and watch them, and then I'd watch them fading off into the distance, and I would dream about what was down that railroad track. And I just imagined there were canyons and rivers and fish and elk and moose and all this wonderful stuff that we never saw in the cornfields of eastern South Dakota. So I just kind of naturally hung out with my cousins and older boys who would go out and seine for minnows in the creek and try to get rabbits with the BB gun, all the usual stuff. And I just got so taken with it that by the time I got into high school, I sort of gave up sports. Of course, I played baseball and all the sports with the rest of the guys. But gosh, when I realized that, for instance, football season would be going on when pheasant season was open, I lost interest in footballs really quickly. So I was just besotted with this whole idea. So I would hunt and hunt and hunt some more. Waterfowl and pheasants and cottontails and jackrabbits were the big thing in eastern South Dakota back then. And that would keep me going well into January, because the jackrabbit hunting would be open and you could just walk all those big farm fields and jump jackrabbits by the scores. And just, we didn't really have deer, but the whitetail started coming in and I was able to bow hunt for whitetails. So I started doing that and just kept it up, making my own decoys and running a trap line and stretching furs and just anything and everything that had to do with the outdoors.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, like you said, I mean, that's kind of the story of our industry is so many people that have made a career out of this industry has started out like that with a passion and a love and that started as when they're little. But that translated into a career, as a writer. Talk about the early days. It wasn't easy at first to break into the industry. It was a little different back then, I guess. Talk about the struggles and then eventually becoming a full-time career.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny. It really wasn't much of a struggle to get my first one sold. I'll tell you the story. I've told it before, but I want to start by saying my high school English teacher actually planted the seed for this. I really wasn't thinking of being an outdoor writer, but I was always reading Sports Afield and Outdoor Life and Field and Stream in class. Illegally. I'd hide it behind my big history book. It looked like I was studying until they would catch on. But my English teacher was a hunter and a gun nut. And he saw this interest in me and he said, you know, you do pretty well with your English classes and you write well, kind of a natural talent it seems like you have. You ought to really work on that and write for those magazines you're reading in class all the time. And I thought, what? Write for these magazines? So I asked him about that. What do you mean? He said, well, people get paid to write those articles. Well, that was a light bulb glowing in the back of my mind. So I thought, you know, I'm going to try that someday. So being a rather pragmatic country boy, you've got to do something to get a job and keep the wolf from the door. And I was working with my dad on carpentry projects and painting houses and shingling churches with asphalt shingles and all sorts of grunt work and working on the farm and whatnot. You know, enough to realize that's going to be a hard life, having to work that hard every day. Oh my gosh, my dad would put in 10, 13-hour days sometimes. So I kept thinking about that writing idea, and I thought, well, I'll go to college and see if I can't get an advanced education in something besides hammering nails. Not that I minded it, but I just thought I ought to try that writing idea. So I got an English degree so I could get a teaching certificate. Good backup job. You know, if you need a job, you can teach high school English like my high school English teacher did. And thought, well, that'll give me the summers off to go fishing, but I'll be all tied up in the hunting season.
Yeah.
So I taught school for a couple of years, started off just doing part-time stuff, and then assigned a contract to teach full-time at a high school level while I was banging out some stories. So in my off time, I would write these stories, and I had five of them stacked up and thought, well, I better send them off somewhere and see if I can't sell them. And I knew these hunting magazines well enough that I thought this one would like this particular story and this particular slant, and I'll send it there. And I did pretty well with that because I sent five stories off to five different magazines and sold all five of them.
Wow.
First try.
Right out of the gate. Yeah.
No kidding. So that pretty much sewed it up. I mean, I think I'll keep doing this.
Yeah.
And then it got a little tougher after that. You know, the next couple I thought were really barnstormers and nobody wanted it. You know, I had to change it and learn more about the whole system and how it worked and all. But it was really interesting in that any nobody from Nowheresville like me could produce a story, send it into a publication, and sell it, see your name in lights, so to speak,
yeah,
which was kind of a big deal for a young guy, and then actually get a check for it. So that's what kept me going. And I just, over the years, gradually sold a few more until about probably 5-6 or so years into it, I was selling enough that I thought I could go full time with it. And I did that. Of course, I wasn't exactly living in the Taj Mahal at the time, but nothing new there. I knew how to live pretty frugally, and I was able to make it work. And what it taught me, of course, was to buckle down, nose to the grindstone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where a lot of guys who tried this didn't make it. They were much, much better writers than I. You would see them pop up and read, oh my gosh, what a story. This guy really knows how to tell a story. And you figured, I'm going to have to work really hard to keep ahead of this guy. And then he would disappear.
Yeah.
And years later, you would find out, well, he couldn't crank them out with the kind of volume you needed to do, or he got a little bit too fond of the bottle and he was procrastinating or something. So it's a combination of knowing your subject and nose to the grindstone and perseverance. And yeah. If you sell, let's say, sometimes you'd write a story and you'd send it to five different publications and they would all bounce it back to you. So you had to stick with it. You say, now what's wrong with this story? How can I make it appealing? And you would rewrite it and rewrite it and then finally get somebody to buy it. And over the years, that stuff piled up until you got a much better understanding. And then it got to the point where I had published with enough different editors and such that they knew of me or me. And would say, hey, Ron, we need a story pretty desperately. We got a slot in our magazine. Can you mm-hmm. crank something out about? And they knew by then that I hunted deer and elk and moose, and I'd been on some goat hunts and some sheep hunts, whatever they needed, lots of bird hunting and stuff. So that made it a lot easier because they would say, hey, write us this piece yeah. on this topic. So that kept me going.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a I think – when the outdoor industry kind of converted and kind of it changed when television started. And we talked a little bit about, you know, your relationship with Winchester, but as a host, Winchester Legends was a TV series that you hosted. Talk about how that came to fruition and then just, you know, partnering with Winchester at that level at that time in your career.
Yeah. You know, initially I didn't even know it was sponsored by Winchester. The producers just hired me to do this series, and they sent me on the first hunt, and I said, well, which rifle do I bring? Which scope do I bring? I don't understand. And they said, don't worry about it. We'll tell you when you need to know. So I'm on a need to know basis. And it was at the last minute that I found out I should probably take a Winchester Model 70 along.
Yep.
And can't go wrong. I've forgotten the scope, but, you know, that's when I found out a box comes in the mail with some Winchester ammunition in it to match the rifle I told him I wanted to take, and bingo, I was off and running. And I was really tickled because, you know, as a boy, Winchester was a really, really big name. And I was shooting yellow box 22s and 12-gauge shells and everything else at all those rabbits and pheasants in South Dakota, so it really felt comfortable. It was kind of a natural fit. And I was proud to be out there representing that. And then it was, hey, fly here, fly there. Here's a ticket to go to this outfitter and hunt for this and that for the first year or two. And then it became, can you find some places to go? What would you like to hunt? So I would contact different outfitters too and just say, hey, I'd like to do a television show hunting with you. It sounds like an exciting place to to be in, et cetera. And we would just put them together.
Yeah.
And pretty much take up the whole fall. I think I started off doing 13 shows. And if you think 13 weeks, especially with big game hunting, you know, you don't go deep into the winter season. So you're starting in probably October or late September, mid-September.
Yep.
And it gets to be kind of back-to-back sometimes. There are many a times when I would land and wash my underwear and take off the next day for the next hunt.
How many seasons was Winchester Legends running?
Do you remember? I don't really remember.
I feel like it was 4 or 5 at least, wasn't it?
Something like that. That sounds about right.
Yeah. So I mean, so say there's 60 episodes over the 4 or 5 seasons. You got to go a lot of places. Is there a moment or a hunt or a specific location that really sticks out in all those, you know, as you're hosting from a hosting standpoint?
Boy, nothing really leaps to the top. They were all pretty exciting and a lot of fun. Gosh, I can remember mountain goat hunts in the snow, moose hunts in the snow, getting rained on excessively. I remember one time we were doing caribou, and I think I had a black bear tag as well. They said, pick up a black bear tag because we might run into one. We're pretty far north, but we're starting to see some around here. They don't cost all that much. Pick one up. And then if we finish early, we can add another hunt in there. Sounded good. And we spot a black bear to the north of us and tried to get in on him and lost him in the scrubby brush or something and never did get that bear. But when we got back to camp saying that we'd seen one there, the camp said, well, there's a polar bear one of our other hunters saw. And we talked about a polar bear, pretty exciting. Where was he? Figured to be a lot farther north. He was to the south. So I just thought that is pretty remarkable to find a polar bear roaming around south of a black bear.
Yeah,
that was an eye opener.
You don't hear that much. Don't hear that much.
No kidding.
Yeah, so you know, kind of transitioning in the shooting. You've really made your name. You know, your YouTube channel has over 600,000 subscribers, and it's growing. It seems like it continues to grow. You release a video, it's got 40, 50, 60,000 views on it within a couple days. You're a voice for the shooter. And your expertise is, you know, people want to hear what you have to say. You spent decades behind the rifle. You know, what's the biggest misconception people have about becoming a great shooter?
Becoming a great shooter. I think too many of them think it's absolutely the equipment. You have to buy the perfect rifle with the perfect scope. And I think they get too large of a scope. For a hunter, this stuff works great for long range steel target shooting kind of stuff. But for hunting, I think too many new hunters these days don't have the kind of on the ground rural experience we did way back when, because it was much easier back then to get there. Nowadays, you grow up in suburbia or an urban center and you want to be out in the wilderness the way I did when I was a kid. I could at least walk down those railroad tracks until I found a wild spot of some kind. Whereas, gosh, now you're going to have to get on a vehicle of some kind and probably drive a few hours from town. And then it's scratch your head. Where am I going to hunt? If you don't have public land around, you've got to find a private place. Used to be we could even get onto private places pretty easily. And now that's difficult because everyone charges for it, or they're just tired of people abusing their land and not being responsible hunters and all the rest of it. So it's a big challenge. So I think a lot of guys are real interested in it, but because they can't actually get on the ground to be hunters, they concentrate more on equipment. Mm-hmm. And they think, well, if I buy the latest, greatest rifle designed to shoot precisely out to 1,000 yards, I'm going to be a heck of a hunter someday. And they may be with that equipment, but it seems that most experienced hunters begin to realize you need to move fast. You need to be light and able to travel, because hunting is about, you're a wolf or a lion or a mountain lion or something where you're hunting. And then your tools, your claws and your fangs are your rifle and your scope and all.
Sure.
And how much of that do you really need?
Yeah.
You know, mountain lion wouldn't do very well if he was all claws and all fangs. He's got to have some good limber legs to cover country and sneak close. So yeah. I think that's kind of the mistake they make.
Yeah. No, I like that analogy. And I think, you know, it kind of rings true now. There's a lot of shooters and you know, a lot of shooters across the country, across the world, are kind of pushing the limits and distance. They're getting to the ranges. They're ringing steel. But what I think, to your point, as a hunter, there's a difference between a good shooter and a good hunter. You got to that's got to translate into the field. So I like that point you just made. So on that point, what's a common mistake that you see experienced hunters make in the field? You know, whether it's from shooting, whether it's the wrong rifle, the wrong cartridge. What is it that you see that pops up for unsuccessful hunts across the country that you've kind of seen over the years?
You know, the most common one seems to be magnumitis. When a competent hunter decides I'm going to go on my first elk hunt, something semi-exotic out west, big animal, a big bear or a moose or something like that, I need to buy a Magnum. And Magnums are fine. In the 20th century, the Magnum thing began because the only option we had for making a better shot at distance was a flatter trajectory, because we couldn't tell exactly how far that animal was away. You kind of had to guesstimate it. And once you get out past 300 yards, another 20, 25 yards of distance makes a big difference in how much your bullet is dropping, because that drop just accelerates at range. So if you could drive the bullet faster, you would pick up another 25 yards or maybe even 50 yards, a flat enough trajectory to still hit your elk or deer or moose out there at significant distances. And I think that got people started in the Magnum. And then they made the mistake of assuming, well, because this, say, 300 Winchester Magnum, which is one heck of a world beater of a cartridge, because this thing throws a bullet 300, maybe even 400 feet per second faster than does a .30-06 or a .308 Winchester, that means I'm going to kill that animal harder, faster, better, deader. It's that incredible knockdown power. And yes, you get more energy in that bullet when it hits the target, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to hammer it into the ground, because most of what terminates an animal is where that bullet lands, not so much it's the energy that it's carrying. Yes, you want a bigger bullet with more mass to penetrate deeply on any given sized animal, but that bullet has to do work when it gets there. It has to expand reliably, and it has to tear the vital tissues. And if you hit the heart and lungs, you're causing hemorrhaging, and that animal then essentially bleeds out. And this is why so many people will hit a deer and they'll say, it takes off running like I didn't even hit it. And then all of a sudden it starts to kind of run in a half circle and it spins around and it falls over. What the hey? Why didn't I knock it down? I shot him with a 300 Magnum. Well, yes, the bullet had a lot of energy and it damaged a lot of tissue, but no mammal I know of dies instantly necessarily from a heart shot or a lung shot. It's the hemorrhaging that drops the blood pressure to the brain. You know, your brain is obviously what's telling you to run, escape, or whatever you're doing. And your brain cells are still alive and functioning because you didn't shoot that. The heart is pumping fresh oxygenated blood to the brain to feed those brain cells and keep it alive. So if you talk to a doctor about this, they'll say, you know, once your blood pressure drops, you faint, essentially. You just lose consciousness. But you're still essentially alive because your brain cell's still alive. And they say it takes about 10 minutes for the brain cell to die if it doesn't get fresh oxygen. So you take out the pumping system, you're going to get that animal, but it's not going to be instantaneous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's what too many hunters don't understand that. So they buy the big Magnum, and then they make a shot and they wonder, well, what the hey? Why didn't it just collapse right there? Look at all that energy I put on it.
Sure.
But the bigger issue that I hear from all kinds of guides and outfitters, these folks will show up with a new Magnum and they haven't worked with it enough and they're afraid of it and they won't shoot it well. Mm-hmm. So you're throwing big bullets out there at high velocity, but you're afraid of the rifle, so you close your eyes and flinch, and then you don't hit it. So, I mean, I had one outfitter in Montana I worked with quite a bit, and he said, I always keep a 243 Winchester in the back of the truck for these guys that after they've missed about six or seven mule deer with their 300 magnums, I say, here, try this. And they shoot a couple of targets with it, and they see that they put the hole where it belonged, and it didn't hurt when they pulled the trigger and all the rest of it, and then they get their deer.
Yeah, you know, that's great. I think there's another misconception, too, and I hear this a lot, is I shot my deer, but it didn't pass through. It stayed on the, you know, it never, well, there are cartridges designed to stay inside to keep that maximum energy inside the cavity. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that is a real popular contention. You've got kind of two camps. You got the guys who want to shoot through, and then you've got two holes, so you've got a better blood trail. And this is, I think, mostly from experienced hunters who've known over the years, I made a perfect shot, but the animal ran. It was essentially dead on its feet. And then it was difficult to find it because there was a lot of brush. It was dry. Mm-hmm. And I had a heck of a time. But when I got there and saw the damage that bullet did, well, there's no doubt it was a wonderful killing shot. And that bullet tore the heart and caused a lot of hemorrhaging. But gee whiz, in 5 seconds, a deer can get pretty far away in heavy cover and be difficult to recover without that blood trail. But then there's the other side where the bullet hits and it fragments, does a lot of damage over a large area. A lot of guys will call it the grenading effect. And you'll recognize that with varmint bullets. They're designed to do that. And you get a really quick demise of an animal with that because you've thrown the damage in such a wide area. And I've done that. Gosh, I remember one. I don't remember if it was for the Winchester World of Whitetail show, I think I did. And I shot this little buck down in Texas. And the bullet it was a 243 with a really light varmint bullet. Exactly why I had that on a deer hunt. Maybe we thought we were going out for coyotes and something, and then the deer showed up. But I remember going, well, I better make a perfect shot in the lungs with this varmint bullet. And I did, right behind the shoulder, and the bullet did what it was supposed to do. It blew up like that inside. Oh, my gosh, that animal died so quickly. With a normal bullet on that same shot behind the shoulder, I would have expected that deer to jump up and run for 30 to 100 yards before it expired. But this guy just took one leap and fell into the bushes stone dead. It was pretty impressive stuff.
You know, that's a real interesting story. And, you know, I think that just goes to it kind of leads me into this. You in the field, testing ammunition. This last year, Winchester launched Supreme Long Range. Just like a lot of their ammunition, you get to test it and use it year, sometimes 2 years before it even hits the shelf. Talk about, first of all, what you found in the field. And then also talk about just the technology that they put into designing that cartridge and why you think it was an important cartridge for the Winchester ammunition brand in general.
First of all, the last question, why is it important? Well, of course, these days everybody's interested in high BC bullets. And there are so many different approaches to performance in bullets now that guys are looking for the latest and greatest, and any company wants to stay relevant in that environment, I think needs to keep experimenting and trying to develop new things. So this BC Max bullet that came out of that experiment, I think is quite a good idea and quite valid. And when you look at bullets and bullet types across all the different manufacturers, you kind of scratch your head and say, this one's pretty similar to that one. And that one's pretty similar to the other one. So you end up with your bullets in sort of a category. Your standard cup and core bullet with a jacket with a lead core in it squeezed together. And then people say, well, those come apart. What do we do? Well, let's put a partition wall in it. The Nosler partition is the famous one that started it all way back in 48. And then you get the bonding effect. How do you bond a bullet? You're essentially combining at a metallurgical level, the copper gilding metal jacket with the lead core. All of these different techniques to try to make your bullet perform at certain impact velocities. And then people need to understand how to use that But then you come up with a copper bullet idea, and you got, how are we going to make copper perform to do as well as the lead core? So you've got these categories. This BC Max bullet essentially started with the lead core with the jacket, and then you make a little bit thicker jacket and you taper it just right to get good initial expansion, especially at longer range with a little bit lower velocities, and you're going to get some really good expansion. But they balanced all of that out and then put that little locking ring sort of in the back to hold the two together rather than a chemical bond or a molecular bond. And then you end up with slightly different kind of a bullet that has that sleek shape for long range shooting. So what the engineers, I think, had to do was say, look, if we make this bullet for long range, it actually has to have a long boat tail. It has to have a secant ogive or whatever they went with on their ogive on the thing. Long, sleek nose, pointy and all the rest of it. They understand that stuff. That makes it fly farther and fatter, or flatter, not fatter. But what's it going to do when it gets there? And that's where they have to start thinking about the thicker jacket and thinning it at the tip to balance all these things. So I think what they've gotten now is a bullet that will perform beyond 300 yards pretty reliably and wonderfully accurately. The last time I worked with them about 6 months ago or so, did a lot of target shooting out to 800 yards, and I was impressed with everything. The rifles, especially this couple of Browning rifles that I had there, wow, they were just dropping them in there all the time. And the consistency of the loads of that Winchester ammunition we were using was pretty spot on. In other words, you didn't get one round going 3,000 feet per second and the next one 3,100 and the next one 2,900.
Yeah.
You had them all within about 20 feet per second for consistency. And then out at distance, you've got consistent drops and you're hitting your target. So the accuracy was really impressive. Of course, steel targets at 300 to 800 yards, you don't know what effect that's going to have for terminating an animal.
Sure.
But I was sure impressed with the precision shooting. And that was with more than just one. It was a 6.5 Creedmoor, a 6.5 PRC, and I think a 300 Win Mag is what I was mostly shooting. Mm-hmm. And of course, the rifle is always a big part of that accuracy. But overall, with all the guys that were shooting with us and experimenting, we just seemed to have good, consistent accuracy on all of those bullets and all the different cartridges they were shooting. And I think somebody even took it out to 1,000 yards and shot some pretty incredible groups, well under a minute of angle.
Yeah. No, that was that out in Oregon?
Yes.
At Leupold? Yeah.
Yep, exactly.
We've got an episode that we just put together from that whole experience. So yeah, I mean, you guys were ringing steel for out to 800 yards, and there's a lot of great information that came out of that that experiment out there in Oregon.
The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Firearms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Winchester Kentucky Straight Bourbon, Winchester Air Rifles, and Winchester Optics.
We've been doing a lot of work of late on some things revolving around long range hunting and shooting. And I'm using both of those because not only are people out shooting long range at targets, but there's been over the last 5 to 7 years, a lot bigger push towards long range hunting, people shooting further, people stretching those things out. So let's talk a little bit about just maybe some of the backstory of that for us and where we've been throughout time and where we're going.
Yeah, I think it's a good topic to talk about, and to talk about long range shooting and the how and the why it's become popular. It really comes down to one thing. It's technology, right?
Yeah.
Technology on the optics front, right? There's rifle scopes out there that are just, I mean, those that came before us would have loved to have these scopes, right? I mean, yeah. Just the objectives, the amount of light that they can capture, you know, the telemetry data that can be uploaded right into a scope. I mean, it's pretty incredible, right? So you have great optics, you have great rifles. Well, you need great ammo to be able to go into those rifles to be able to, you know, complete that system to ultimately achieve that sub MOA accuracy, or in many cases nowadays, well below sub MOA accuracy. And, you know, why do you need sub MOA accuracy to shoot at 500, 600, 700 yards? Well, you need that very tight grouping to make sure that, you know, when projectiles ultimately disperse that far down range, that you're still on target, whether your target is, you know, an appropriate medium sized or big game animal, or, you know, whether you're trying to hit a 4x4 sheet of steel at 700 yards, right?
Yeah. So in the last 5-7 years, BC has become like the thing a lot of people, like when we first started, yeah, everyone knew ballistic coefficient, and
you needed to know it to know what your drop and trajectory was,
right? Yeah, I mean, you had trajectory tables all the time, and, you know, people were slapping those on the side of their stock when they were going out there, or just having some kind of way to calculate that, but as time has gone on, it's really chasing these even higher BC, higher ballistic coefficient bullets. And maybe explain a little bit as to why that's important and where that's coming in for these long range hunters slash shooters.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, at first we need to understand what BC is, right? And it really is a measurement of how well a projectile can defeat drag, if you will, right? So ultimately, the higher the BC number, ballistic coefficient, the less drag essentially is going to be on that projectile. And a higher BC means it's going to retain more velocity further downrange. Well, if it's maintaining more velocity, it's maintaining more energy downrange. And additionally, the trajectory is going to be flatter, right? It's not going to have as much drop at a given distance. So, you know, ultimately, that quest for the highest possible BC bullet is one that's a novel one when ultimately we're trying to push the ranges further and further. Because at the end of the day, you know, 3 feet of drop at 400 yards is a lot better than 6 feet of drop, right? Because if it's 3 feet at 400 yards, it might be 10, 12 feet at, you know, 600, 700, 800, 900 yards, depending on what cartridge we're talking about. So, you know, that's the ultimate quest.
Another thing I think gets lost a little bit whenever people are chasing the BC thing and looking for the biggest number is that BC does not necessarily equate to accuracy.
That's right.
So when it comes to long range hunting, shooting, you got to be accurate. I mean, you mentioned it before, you know, you got to be, you know, a sub MOA type situation for, if you're going to shoot something at 500 plus, the more accurate you can be, obviously not just the better, it's almost required to be able to effectively take those kinds of shots. So when it comes to a long range product, you know, when we're looking at things and when we're developing things, it's not just about creating the highest BC, it's a balancing act. You got to find the highest that we can get to, but yet still get precision.
You know, you talked about the capabilities a minute ago. So this cartridge is going to be well suited for shooting on the range, whether you're trying to shoot paper at those kind of long distances, whether you're trying to engage steel targets or something reactive at those long distances. But at the same time, we didn't ignore terminal performance on this bullet at all, right?
In fact, it's probably one of the reasons why it's taken us so long, right, to get there. It's because we wanted to fully understand what its capabilities were.
That's right. We didn't just want to make a long range shooting bullet and say, well, some people might take this hunting, it should kind of work some of the time. No, that was not going to be the answer at all. So, you know, this went through all the same ballistic gelatin testing protocols that we put any of our big game hunting bullets through. You know, we took it out of field multiple seasons, not just one season, multiple seasons. Yeah. You know, we've harvested everything from elk to nilgai to, you know, antelope, kudu, zebra. I mean, this bullet has been tested on really everything out there just to make sure the terminal performance is there, right? We want to make sure it was effective. This is completely different. Supreme long range, we want people out there going and optimizing the performance, you know, in their individual rifle system, and I'm excited to get it out in everybody's hands.
Well, I think we did a pretty solid job of covering Supreme. If you guys got any other questions about Supreme Long Range or any of our other products, you can go to winchester.com.
Nylo, The prestigious Winchester Hunting and Shooting Sports Facility is now an Orvis-endorsed hunting grounds. Over the course of more than 160 years, Orvis has built a brand synonymous with quality, integrity, and the finest service standards in the industry. This recognition ensures that visitors of an Orvis-endorsed operation encounter unparalleled service, respect for natural resources, and an experienced, professional staff. Located in Brighton, Illinois, Nyla was founded by John M. Olin in 1952 as an ideal model of conservation. Nyla is dedicated to unsurpassed upland hunting, sport shooting, and some of the finest hunting dogs in the country. Over time, Nyla has filled its guest books with distinguished names and hosted shooting sports competitions and events, benefiting various national and local charities. For more information and to book your shooting sports or hunting experience, visit nylofarms.com. You know, you talk about ballistic coefficients. Why is that important in the Supreme long range cartridge?
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, even in relatively reasonable range, it does matter. A lot of guys will chew me out for this. They think I talk about BC too much. I think I worship at the feet of BC and all. It's like, no, guys, this is just basic physics. All it is efficiency. Guys always like to talk about using a cartridge that's more efficient. Rather than getting a big high powder volume magnum, they go with the 308 Winchester because it's efficient. I can understand that. But the same thing applies to bullets. You can have a bullet and use a bunch of powder to drive it really, really fast. But if it has a low BC, low aerodynamic shape, it's going to use up its kinetic energy, pushing air out of its way, essentially. The drag increases. So yeah, you start off with a heck of a lot of velocity, but you lose it quickly and then your bullet drops more and you lose energy. So many guys will complain and say, oh, it doesn't matter out to 300 yards. It's all the same. Well, it's closer, but it's not all the same. And I would often take a round nose 308 bullet, 150 grains, drive it at the same velocity as a spire point boat tail at 150 grains to show the significant difference in drops and deflection in the wind and retain energy. And most of these guys who complain about this obsession with BC don't consider the retained energy. They're all interested in having a magnum with more knockdown power and a lot more energy in it, but they kind of forget to think about how does BC contribute to that? Mm-hmm. And it conserves a lot of energy. You can end up with hundreds of foot-pounds more energy remaining in your bullet at 400 yards or even 300 yards if you have the high BC bullet versus the flat nose or the round nose. So, yeah, BC matters with efficiency. And the nice thing about it is it doesn't cost you anymore. You don't have to burn more powder to get it. You don't have to suffer more recoil to get it. You just shoot that bullet at the same velocities and let it keep flying because it's efficient at getting through the air to your target.
In the Supreme long range, I mean, that is something that's built into that bullet, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm confident that's part of the reason, a significant part of why they made it. It's, look, we can drive a PowerPoint as fast as we can drive this one if it's the same weight from the same cartridge. But look at how much more performance we retain in this BC Max bullet. Who wouldn't want that? More energy on target, you're going to get more expansion on your bullet. You're going to be doing more damage when you get there.
Yeah. Did you, in the last year or two, you took this, the Supreme long range, you took it out and hunted with it, didn't you?
Yeah, we did a mule deer hunt in Colorado a couple of years ago with this is a different permutation of that bullet. It's while they were designing it and engineering it and testing it and stuff, say, try this version, try that version. And we had whatever version was out right then, experimental stuff, and we're trying to get elk and mule deer. Never got a crack at an elk, but I took a decent 4x4 mule deer buck, and there's really not much to say about it other than bang flop, because we sneaked up on this guy at last light, and We had a big stack of hay bales out there. And once you line up that stack of hay bales with your animal, it's pretty easy to get closer. And I'm old school. I always want to get closer.
Yeah.
So I ended up inside of 200 yards, as I recall, on this guy and put it on his shoulder. And it was just instant dead right there. Kind of whoopee-doo shot that we all strive for. So it really didn't test the long range abilities of the bullet, but my goodness, shooting a 300 Win Mag, hitting a mule deer on your shoulder with that big bullet and down he went, you kind of expected more of the same on that one.
Yeah.
So it worked out beautifully on that. I wish we could have gotten an elk with it because that would have been a little heavier animal. Yeah, it would have been a better test for penetration on something.
It would have been a better test, like that. Yeah. But, you know... Yeah. It is hunting. And I actually went, I looked at all that footage. That was shot, I think, two falls ago. I went through all that footage not too long ago. I can attest that mule deer didn't go far.
Yeah, no, about 2 feet down.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite Winchester rifle cartridge combination that you kind of keep coming back to? And I know it all depends on, you know, what you're hunting, etc. But is there like a one that you're like, yep, this is my go-to?
Well, for nostalgic reasons as well as performance reasons, Model 70 and a 270 Winchester is just darn hard to beat. You run the numbers, especially with some of these modern bullets like the BC Max and such. When you get your BCs up like that out of a 270 with the mild recoil and how easy it is to shoot and all, you realize that your trajectory performance is just right on the heels of, say, a 7mm Remington Magnum.
Yeah.
And without that big powder supply and all, you just go, gosh, this thing is so darned effective. And I used, you know, a lot of guys will say the 270 is kind of borderline for elk. You really ought to use something bigger. But plenty of guys have used it successfully, especially with a 150 grain bullet.
Yeah.
I was doing one of the Winchester shows. I think we were shooting the XBR rifle on that, but it was 270 Winchester.
Mm-hmm.
And we crawled up on this herd of elk, and I picked out the 6x6 bull. And when he stood up, I shot him right behind his shoulder, I believe. And he sort of took these little stiff baby steps forward about 10 yards or so and stopped. And I thought, well, I better give him another one. The bullet I was using was 130 grain. Which one was it? Ballistic
yep.
Silvertip.
Yep, BST, yeah.
But dead right there. I gave him a second shot while he was wobbling and standing there just because with elk, that's what you do.
Sure.
You always shoot until they're down because they can pull some stuff on you sometimes.
Yeah.
But really that second shot I could see wasn't needed because he was definitely ready to topple over.
Yeah.
And when that second bullet hit him, plunk, down he went.
So in big game cartridge innovation, Winchester's led the way in the last, you know, since I can remember, I think since everybody can remember. Talk about their leadership in general, just in big game cartridge innovations.
Yeah, well, of course, in the 20th century, they were just on top of it. There were so many cartridges. My gosh, I mean, think about the 220 Swift. Winchester comes out with that thing in 1935, and it adds something like 1,500 feet per second more velocity than the next fastest 22 centerfire in existence.
Yeah, it's incredible. Like,
that's not an evolution. That's a complete revolution. Yeah. What an amazing cartridge. And then, of course, the 270 in 1925. Holy mackerel, that set the world on fire. And they just kept going. And then when they started with the belted magnums and stuff in the 60s, that 300 Win Mag in 1963 was like, holy mackerel. But prior to that, you know, that the little sleeper was a 308 Winchester. And I don't know if you know this, but Winchester was working with the government, with the military to find a replacement for the 30-06 to make a little more efficient rifle and lighter ammunition to carry around for logistic reasons and such. And they hit on this 308. They kind of got the idea from the 300 Savage. Mm-hmm. And thought, well, what could we do? And then they worked with the 30-06 case, shortened things up and probably used some new powders at the time, who knows exactly what. But when they had that 308, they thought, boy, the military didn't just immediately grab it, but Winchester thought it was viable enough that they released it as a commercial cartridge.
Sure.
In 1952, I believe it was.
Yep.
And that was another couple of years before the military finally took it on as the official. Well, of course, once they do that, you're golden. And yep. that 308 Winchester, obviously today, is just one of the top three out there for lots of good reasons. It pretty much the Goldilocks cartridge. Not too fast, not too slow. It's just right.
Yep. It's just
too
right.
Too much recoil. Just right. Yeah. Yep. And so that was
yeah,
but you know that's one of those cartridges, Jason, that Winchester I don't think gets a lot of credit for. Everybody knows it's the 308. It's the 308. It's the 308 Winchester. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks 300 Winchester Magnum or 270 Winchester. Those really stand out, but the 308 is just kind of a military cartridge. But it was really a Winchester.
No, that's and great. That, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that's one most people don't think of.
Yeah, and I, you know, what's funny, there's a lot of, you know, military, you know, films, a lot of snipers. Almost every sniper in these films are shooting 308s. It is like the sniper rifle when you look at these films but it's true, right? I mean, a lot of these snipers, a lot of these long range military, you know, shooters, they're using 308s still, aren't they?
Well, a little bit, but not really, because there's much better options for really long range. You know, the 308 as a sniper rifle is used especially by a lot of police in yep. urban areas and such for 200, 300-yard shots. You start stretching that 308 out to, say, after 600 yards and especially 800, you really start to suffer because there's just not enough powder behind those heavier long, high BC bullets to give them enough velocity to keep going. And it is possible to get a 243 Winchester shooting better at extreme range than a 308 because of the wind deflection issues and the drops and all the rest. Yeah. So I think the bigger part of the reason why it was such a popular sniper in the military was because that's what the official military cartridge was for the infantry. You had a 308. Now, Hathcock, Carlos Whitefeather Hathcock in the Vietnam War, the famous sniper who took out so many of the enemy, was using a 30-06 Winchester, mm-hmm. not the 308.
Yeah.
But I think the typical guy is like, well, Sergeant, I'd like to be a sniper. Well, here's your rifle. It's a 308 Winchester. That's what we shoot.
Yeah.
And so they kept working with it. But now, gosh, you know, the 300 Win Mags, guys started shooting that and going, well, I've got a lot more reach with this thing. You know, they build some special hand loads with the right bullets. And now you've got a real winner because you're shooting so much faster than the 308. But the 308 has this incredible accuracy reputation, which is well-deserved. Mm-hmm. I think a significant part of that is the fact that because it kind of feeds on itself. Because it has a reputation for being a sniper round, they build really accurate ammunition for it. And they also build really accurate rifles that match grade barrels, match grade chambers, and all the rest of it. Put a good trigger on it, and it just gives people the mindset, I'm shooting a really accurate cartridge, so I'm going to shoot really accurately. Whereas with a 270, it's like, it's a deer cartridge, it's a hunting cartridge. Nobody puts extra effort into trying to make that as accurate as they can.
That's a great point. That's a great point. Yeah, it's a lot of mental stuff, you know, and I think that's kind of what separates a good shooter from a, you know, just a shooter is confidence a little bit, I think, in that mindset. And I think you're right when you talk about that.
It's nice to be right once in a while.
So, big game cartridges, Deer Season XP, Ballistic Silver Tip, Power Point. I mean, you've shot them all. What's your favorite? What's your favorite bullet of choice for big game North American animals?
Boy, you know, I really don't have one. I think the thing about having a favorite bullet is applied to what? My favorite bullet for a deer using a 30-30 in a traditional woods kind of thing is going to be completely different than a 300 Win Mag bullet at range out on the open plains.
That's right.
So I really can't say I have a favorite bullet. It's always, what is my bullet for this particular velocity in this terrain?
Yeah, and that's what makes it fun.
And that makes the fun part is that you then experiment with this stuff. You get out on the range and you try it and you realize, all right, I'm going to be going with this PowerPoint bullet in my 30-30, but in my 30-06, I'm probably going to use a ballistic silver tip for deer at reasonable ranges out to 300 or so. But if I'm going to start taking down, say, a moose with my 30-06, I'm going to get a heavier bullet, going to be at least 180, and maybe a partition or something like that. So there's a lot of differences. I just don't, yeah. I don't buy into this, guys who say, well, this is the absolute best bullet. I use it for everything all the time. That just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
You're right. 100%. And this kind of, this is a thought. If you had one rifle and one cartridge for North America, you just had to pick one combination, what would it be?
Oh, man. Years ago, I looking at all the numbers and studying the ballistics like I do and everything, I thought, you know, much as I think the 300 Win Mag is the ultimate all-around do-it-all kind of thing, I think the 7 Rem Mag can do much the same with a little bit less powder and a little bit less recoil. Not that it was significant enough to really bother with, but I'm also a little bit of a, I don't know, iconoclast. I sort of like to do things oddball that others don't like to do. You know, choose the cartridge that's the least popular and see what you can do with it, sort of a thing. So then I thought, yeah, I'd probably go with that 7 Rem Mag. But in honesty, if people push me on it and ask which really is the more versatile cartridge, I do have to say it's a 300 Win Mag.
Yeah.
Just because with the 7 Rem Mag, you pretty much top out with 175 grain bullet, which I think is more than heavy enough, tough enough, and all the rest of it to take down anything with a good shot. But with the Winchester 300, now you're easily pushing 200 grain bullets, 210, 12 grain bullets, even 220 grain bullets. Mm-hmm. Gives you a little more versatility if you want to go there.
Yeah.
I don't think they're essential, but you know, a lot of guys say, look, if I'm going up against a big moose or an eland in Africa that's 1,500 to 1,800 pounds, I want a 220 grain bullet. That's going to really penetrate deeply and all the rest of it. You've got the option with that 300.
Yeah. No, it is a great point. And I think I've asked that question to a couple guests. And ironically enough, the 300 Win Mag is also been the popular answer for those exact reasons. You talk about long range shooting quite a bit on your videos, on your YouTube channel. Where do you think the line is between ethical long range hunting and pushing the limits? I know there's a fine line there. Where do you think that threshold is?
Yeah, that's a great question. We all have to kind of come to grips with it. But one of the good ways to choose that is by time of flight of your bullet and thinking, now, if my bullet requires 3/4 of a second to get there, I mean, that's like nothing. But still, if the instant your brain says, squeeze the trigger and launch that bullet, the animal says, I think I'll take a step forward, or I'll lie down or do something different. He can get enough movement by the time the bullet actually launches and flies through the air and gets there in 3/4 of a second, your chest shot has turned into a gut shot or something along those lines. And I speak from experience on this. I was once shooting some Winchester ammunition in a Dakota single shot rifle on a pronghorn hunt. And just when I was squeezing the trigger on his beautiful broadside shot, that animal decided to turn, and when the bullet got there, I hit it in the ham, going away kind of a shot. And then it was chase him around and put the finishing shot into him. We almost lost him. So that was kind of an eye-opener for me. And that was only about 300, 325-yard shot. So you stretch that out to 600 yards, holy mackerel. I might have hit him in the foot.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, I don't think people think about that often enough in long range shooting. Again, it's all situational, and it's you're not at a range, you're not shooting steel at 800 yards. This is you got nature, you got wind, you've got elements, you've got all the things that make hunting what it is and why people love it so much. And I think when you break it down like that, it does give you that extra thing to consider when you're pushing the limits out there, especially out west, when you start chasing big game animals out there.
You bet. No, I think most of us say, well, look, I've got this incredible rifle. It's wonderfully accurate, this great scope, and my ammunition always drops these bullets into a half MOA, so I can take an animal clear out to 800 yards, no problem. Half MOA at 800 yards, I'm keeping my bullets inside of about a 4-4.5-inch circle.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah.
But then, like you said, do you really know what the wind's doing over that entire distance? That makes a huge difference on where that bullet lands. Yeah, you can memorize your drops and be perfect that way. You can dial your scope and all the rest of it. But there are so many variables that enter into it when you're in the wild.
Yeah.
You're not on the bench. You're not necessarily lying perfectly prone with a good bipod under the front. You may be shooting through a gap in the mountain range. You've got wind coming down through a channel that you don't really recognize because you can't see it. I mean, I've had that happen on a 450-yard shot on a big elk. There was a canyon between us, and I knew there was some air movement down through that canyon, but I wasn't in it to feel it, had no way to read it, and it ends up blowing my bullet back past the lungs, essentially a gut shot. Fortunately, it was open enough terrain and all that I was able to compensate on my next shot and drop him. But things like that one has to consider. And if you get a little cocky, especially if you're a heck of a steel shooter and you're very successful at that game, you just get a little bit ahead of yourself and you try it out in the wilds when these conditions aren't all that predictable.
Yeah.
And you end up with a wounding shot. And it's a lot different to hit the edge of a steel target versus the edge of a deer or an elk.
That's right. You know, and you've talked about this too, kind of the debate between fast and flat versus heavy and proven. Where do you land on that? And where do Winchester cartridges fit into that argument today?
The fast and flat bullets, the lighter bullets versus the heavy, slower?
Yep, yep.
That's the old Jack O'Connor, Elmer Keith debate.
Yeah, that's right.
I go toward more toward the lighter, faster bullets and the more precise shooting ones. Back in those days when Elmer Keith was advocating for a 33 caliber or larger and a 200 grain or heavier bullet and all the rest of it, yes, those work. Those always work, and it never really hurts to use more than you need.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're talking a lighter bullet and it's just right, but if something goes a little bit wrong, do you really have enough to make a difference? And all those arguments are valid, but things have changed, especially in bullet technology, from those days to now. Back then, when you just had the PowerPoint type of bullet, where you've got a jacket and a lead core and the two aren't necessarily bonded or locked together or anything like that, you needed a heavier, longer bullet to maintain its mass to drive deep. And that's what Elmer depended on. Plus, he was taking a lot of what he called raking shots. And if you read his book carefully, Hell, I Was There, you realize that he's taking 400 to 600 yard shots, guesstimated distances, on animals that are running away or walking away. It didn't seem like he spent a lot of time waiting for that perfect broadside shot the way so many of us have been trained to do these days.
Yeah.
So he needed a big, heavy 33 caliber, 35 caliber bullet that would go through the hip, break a bone, go through the guts to get up through the diaphragm to get into the lungs to take it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why he needed that stuff.
Yeah.
I think Jack was more of a, you know, get the right angle and make the right shot with this 130 grain 270 bullet, you're going to do just fine. And throughout my career, I have found that to be the case. If you put that bullet in the right place, it doesn't really matter how fast it was going when it got there. You're going to get your animal with the right bullet in the right place.
Yeah.
Obviously, the right bullet means it's going to expand enough when it gets there, carry its energy, penetrate deeply to damage enough tissue to do the job. But you don't need the kind of mass you needed back in Elmer's day. And then the argument about a slow velocity tied to that heavier bullet for better penetration, that makes sense because your bullet doesn't expand as much, so there's not as much friction as it moves through the target, so you get more penetration with a lower impact velocity.
Mm-hmm.
Heavier bullets have more momentum.
Yep.
And that definitely is a good thing to have and works to your advantage. But again, with modern bullet designs and materials and all that, you're getting that kind of a performance out of a lighter bullet as well. So then you've got to figure it, well, okay, it's a lighter bullet, but I'm not afraid to shoot it. My 35 Whalen or my 458 Winchester Magnum, I'm going to be a little bit afraid of pulling that trigger. I might not make that perfect shot.
Those are all obviously good points. And I think a lot of it too, you've experienced so much of this. You've shot animals with fast and flat. You've shot animals with heavy and proven. You've hunted dozens of species around the world. After all of that, you know, you've been in the industry for decades, as a writer, as a host, as an expert. What still excites you today when you pick up that rifle? When you pick up that rifle, pair it with ammunition, what is it that still excites you to get out there and do it today?
You know, the whole thing, I think, is a touchstone to everything you've wanted, everything you've done. You know, the familiarity of feeling that rifle in your hands informs you, and even if you don't consciously think about everything that you've done with that rifle or any rifle, you're thinking about possibilities for what's happening now. I think it's a big part of hunting for all of us is preparing for it and thinking about it. The dreaming part of it is actually, we do a lot more of that than we do actual hunting. But once I pick that rifle up and I'm heading out, I've got this hope for the future. So it kind of pulls me along. Like anything in life that you really enjoy, that doing that sort of thing, anticipating and preparing for it and all of it adds so much joy to your life. I think it ties in with that old statement about your days spent hunting do not count against your allotted time on earth.
Which is, I like that.
Well, you're having so much fun and there's so much joy in it that you don't feel like you've worked or there goes another day. It just adds more to your life. And I think the joy is a combination of discovering the mystery that all of us have in our minds when we think of hunting. You're thinking of the mystery of this wild country you've never been to before. And possibly even no man has ever put his foot on this particular rock before. I'm the first one here. How marvelous is that? And then you see this animal, like I saw a caribou once up in the wilds of British Columbia that I'll swear no one ever saw before. This thing was an absolute Boone and Crockett monster. I didn't go after him. I was on a sheep hunt, but my gosh, I'm thinking that animal spent how many years living out here and in this howling wilderness.
Yeah.
I mean, we had to fly for hours to get there and then hike for 9-10 miles to get back into this mountain range. I'll bet no human has ever laid eyes on this animal before. How special is that?
So special.
That I got to see him.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. So just picking up the rifle or even looking at it, I think this is why a lot of guys like to have the rifle out and on the wall, if not worried about thieves breaking in and stuff, but have that there to glance at it and you just sort of stop and think about some aspect of your outdoor life.
It's a reminder. It's a reminder. Yeah.
It's a reminder that just brings that joy that you've experienced right back to the surface. So yeah, both looking back and looking forward at the same time.
I love that. Wrapping up here, I mean, I think Winchester's played such a huge role in so many people's lives. The brand, what it stands for, and what it always has been within our country. What does it mean to you to be a part of Winchester's story, you know, after decades working with them?
I never thought of that. I guess it's kind of special. You know, you think about Jack O'Connor, he was kind of tied in, and Elmer Keith as well. They were tied in with Winchester a lot, did a lot of consulting and developing different cartridges and rifles and different things. And as a part of that world, as a gun writer, outdoor writer, now YouTuber covering the same topics, and in influencing people, I think I have a strong responsibility to my audience to try to give them the straight scoop. And I often tell them, look, guys, this has been my experience. I've done a lot of research, but go and check for yourself. Double check me, because there's so many people online now and on YouTube and whatnot telling you what to do, and not all of it is right. And it's quite possible for me to get things wrong as well. But The idea is that I wanted to share what I've learned, kind of help you out the same as I've been helped out by so many mentors over the years, including the writers who I never met personally, but I learned a lot by reading their stuff. So I think that's an important part of what I do. And it gives me a great satisfaction to know that, well, people will come up and say, oh, I watched your show on Winchester Legends where you went hunting for that caribou. And wow, that got me so excited that I'm going next year. And you realize that, gee, little old me, this country boy from South Dakota, is influencing people. And they're writing back to say a huge accomplishment and joy in their life was inspired by little old me. So it's really kind of humbling. Yeah. At the same time, that makes me feel pretty special to be tied in with someone who, like Winchester, who sponsored those shows and enabled me to take some of those hunts and have those experiences and put me in the same kind of the same world as some of these famous writers from yesteryear back in the 20th century. Pretty yeah. special stuff.
Pretty special. Well said. And, the great Ron Spomer, thank you so much for spending time today and chatting with us. There's so much more we could have got into. I've got so many questions that I had that we never got to, but that's all right. We'll have to do this again sometime, and I thank you so much for spending time with us today on the Winchester Life Podcast.
Well, you're more than welcome, Jason. I had a great time visiting with you. Thanks for the reminiscences. You got me thinking about things I hadn't thought about in a while.
Love that.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please make sure you click the follow button on your podcast apps so you never miss a new episode. This episode was produced by Aaron Cox and Jason Gilbertson, engineered by Jason Freer, directed by Chad Andrus, written and edited by Jason Brown, with behind-the-scenes photography by Kelsey Myers. I'm Jason Brown, and you've been listening to the Winchester Life Podcast. See you next time.